You're listening to Wake Up Hollywood with Nikki Kalula and Eddie Pence, right here on LA Talk Radio.
Wake up, Hollywood. This is your host with the most, Nikki Kalula. We're going to jump right into this interview. We have a very good friend of mine for decades, very talented singer-songwriter, very talented dude, multi-instrumentalist, and a great cat, Mr. John Gus. How are you, John?
I'm doing great, Nikki, man. Thanks for having me on, man.
It's hard to see this well-behaved, you know what I mean? Because you know the giggles are going to happen at some point during this interview. It's already starting. Here we go. Let's go.
Well, no, notice I shaved off the mustache, so there's no.
I had all these mustache jokes ready to rock, dude. I'm so disappointed. When did you shave the mustache? Because that is a huge, huge step and a huge profit.
Hey, man, it comes on and off on its own, man. It has a life of its own. It just needed to be there that last gig that we did at a hotel.
I love it. You know what? It's like I knew you were up to mayhem and mischief when I saw you show up to the gig. Instead of the boyish face I know and love, you showed up. You showed up a man. You were like, I've been some places. I got some songs and stories for you.
Yeah, this is going to be a fun night of just listening to songs in every other minute. But the mustache.
You're like, that's it. When I come home, I'm shaving this damn thing off.
You were like Austin Powers with the mole. You're like, mole.
You know what? It's so funny because Bonnie, one time, she was like, you know what? Don't ever rock a mustache for me. And I'm like, no. You know what? Just because you said that, I'm going to rock a mustache and see how long that you will go out with me and we'll go into public places. And it was so awesome because you could tell she was a little bit annoyed, but sooner or later, they warm up to the mustache. The Tom Selleck mustache vibe has some secret powers.
Oh, yeah. No. When you're wearing a mustache, you command attention. People look at you differently.
And you're like a sage. You know, just people are like, he must know something I don't. He must know every speakeasy in L.A. You know what I mean?
That man is wearing a mustache. He knows something I need to know.
Something different. Something magical. Some mystical magic powers. Well, it's so good to have you on this show. It's been a long time coming.
Thanks, brother.
One of my favorite songwriters, one of my favorite people on the planet. You came from Connecticut, so let's ask a real brief pizza question. What is your pizza place in Connecticut? Because people from Connecticut are very particular about their pizza joints.
What a great way to start. Whenever anyone asks about Connecticut, that's where they go to first. So first of all, everybody from Connecticut is a pizza snob. They think that they've got the market corner.
That's true.
The New York people are looking at him like, what are you talking about? But to answer your question, Pepe's Pizza in New Haven. I mean, it's to me, that's the pinnacle. There's the whole Pepe's, Sally's, whatever. But nah, man, there's just something about that pizza. It's ridiculous.
Pepe's is amazing. And you know what? I went to New Haven. I think I went to Pepe's because you told me. And it was one of the best pizzas I've had. I ordered a red sauce and a white sauce. And I was like, there ain't no other place. So, like, whenever people talk about pizza places from Connecticut, that's my number one. I'm like, yo, Pepe's? And they're like, Pepe's, yes. So, yeah. Sally's, I haven't even heard of this place, but I can't believe she can contend with Pepe's. It's just, I don't think it's possible.
It's like McDonald's and Burger King, you know. They're both fine for the same amazing market, but okay, bad example. But still, you know what I'm talking about.
Well, I mean, Chicago's like that, too. It's like, Everybody from Chicago loves Lou Malnati's, which I don't think is the best deep dish pizza place. There's three. There's Gino's, Giordano's, and Lou Malnati's. And I love Giordano's. Giordano's, I think, is the best. But everybody from Chicago is like, no. It's Lou Malnati's all day long. All day long is Lou Malnati's. So the debate continues.
Wait, you mean Luminati's? Like, you know,
yes.
Okay.
Not Illuminati's. That,
oh, okay.
Like that Lou cult. and then Manati. Oh.
Lou Manati.
Yeah, exactly. Those are the spots. No. But so you grew up in Connecticut. I know your dad was a great musician. He played saxophone.
That's right.
How did you kind of start getting into the love of music? What was the moment of zen for you that made you want to become a musician or made you fall in love with music?
Oh, boy. He was in a cover band in Connecticut when I was growing up. He played saxophone and he sang lead and backups and everything. And it just sounded fun, you know. But then I remember he had his band rehearse at our house, which didn't happen all the time. And, man, there was just all of this gear, black cases coming in, the PA, the drums, you know, everything's kind of smelled like old cologne.
That's awesome.
And then I remember being upstairs, and for whatever reason, my mom was like, "Be quiet! They're having band practice." And then the whole house was like, just...
"That's awesome!"
It's downstairs, what is this? Yeah, so like he would play with the drums and organ. You know, I kind of say that they kind of sounded like that Whiter Shade of Pale song. You know, like they've
that's awesome. That's awesome
stuff. So yeah, so when I saw him doing that, it was, you know, that's what I want to do. I want to do that thing, man.
Well, and it's also like, you know, how cool is it to see your dad playing music with like and acting probably like a teenager? Because I think musicians kind of turn into like little kids when we play music. That's what makes it so great, you know?
What a wonderful way of saying it. It's the Peter Pan principle of musicianship. Try to say that five times fast. There is something about playing music where all of a sudden you're, for me, I'm 12 years old again, and I'm learning how to play guitar, or at least I'm somewhere there. And if you're on stage and there's just something electric, everybody gets to have fun, and it's almost a reductive effect to a happier, better time for everybody, you know, be it on stage or watching it or whatever. But yeah, here's my dad who was, you know, telling me to, you know, to eat up, brush my teeth and go to bed. And all of a sudden he switched and he's this different personality. And even, and my dad's been gone about 10 years, but those are some of my favorite memories of him. Is watching him play. And then when I started to play and playing music at the same time together, there aren't a lot of opportunities to be like at the same level as your dad, you know, so to say. But here he was allowing me to do so. And you know, here we were communicating on a whole different level. And then my brother playing drums, forget about it. You know, the three of us would enter into this world where we were all kids together, like you said.
That's awesome. And you know what? I wanted to ask you too, like, did you ever start with saxophone, or did you just gravitate originally to guitar just because it was so different?
Yeah, man. Let's go back to 12-year-old little Johnny in Shelton, Connecticut.
So mustache or no mustache?
Believe it or not, no mustache. But there was a glimmer, you know, like that little chocolate milk.
A milk mustache.
Especially after lunch. So this is when all of the hair bands were coming out, and oh my god, you know, so I saw these older kids in their leather jackets and their long hair, and it's like, what's going on over there? And then you started to listen to, you know, that hard rock sound coming out of the East Coast. And you know, this is
so like who were the people that you were like, oh my god, was it like Bon Jovi? Was it like, you know, like, I love all the hair bands, this is why I ask.
I think it was Bon Jovi, Living on a Prayer, that initial synth intro where all of a sudden it's like magic's about to happen. You know? and then we're Richie Sambora with the mouth effect, that's Living on a Prayer. Yeah. I think that the video, you know, MTV was king, and the video came on and it was black and white. And again, these guys looked like, you know, superhuman beings. I think John Bon Jovi was flying through the air in that video, you know. So it was the visual, it was the sound, it was all this stuff just bombarding me. And it's just like, I need to be part of this. And, you know, I think Richie Sambora was playing Strat guitars back then. You know, all loaded up, you know, with the stars on the neck and everything.
Hell yeah.
And I think it was I had been playing Oregon, Oregon since I was 10. I tried that out and, you know, playing Fur Elise and stuff just didn't hit, you know?
Yeah, right.
There
right.
weren't bangers for the organ back then.
You probably have like a church organ. That's what everybody had. They had like an old, they didn't have a Hammond with a Leslie. They had like a church organ. You're thinking that, you know, and I'm sure somebody was like, it's the same. Usually the mom's like, it's the same as a Hammond. Just get a church organ. Then we'll have some, you know, some hymns, you know, being sung in the living room. Yeah, it's not the same. But yeah, I can imagine little John playing on the organ. Like, I just want to get my feet to those pedals.
Can I play Beatles now? No, orally. And it's like, no. Yeah, it's honey. Sears is having a special on Kimball organs this week, you know?
Wow. That's awesome. Well, did you buy an electric guitar first? Did you start on acoustic or did you start on electric?
I started on an electric, and I don't know if that was just like, you know, if that was just bad parenting on my dad's part or something, but it was amazing, you know, and it came with a whammy bar and everything. We, you know, it took me down
That's
there,
awesome.
We, you know, and I think that, it was for Christmas, and, you know, I pick it out. It's like this white Strat copy. God, it was just, I remember just bringing it home and looking at it. Like, what is this magical piece of hardware? What is this thing? You know? And, you know, and I think the whammy bar, I called it the party level lever at that point, you know, like, knocks it out of tune. Who cares? You know, it's rock
and roll. You probably have, did you have like a little PV amp or something, like a little, like a practice amp where you're just like, I'm going to turn this up to 12. It's like, it won't sound as good up there, but you know, it'll still sound like you're rocking, you know, but I'm sure you had a blast with that. You were 12 years old when you picked up guitar. Is that right?
12 years old. Yeah. Right in the middle of that whole 80s scene. And, you know, guitar was king back then.
So, and do you remember like the songs you started gravitating towards? Was it all like hair band stuff, or did you kind of start going into Beatles, like you said? Did you kind of venture into classic rock, Jimi Hendrix, any of that stuff?
Yeah, the first song that I learned on Christmas Day, my dad was he pulled out "House of the Rising Sun."
Wow!
From the Animals, I have that right?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, and I remember like it just kind of came to me and I was playing it and we were going over to my Uncle Ron's house either that day or the next day. And he's like, bring your guitar and started playing House of the Rising Sun. And my uncle got his guitar and I'm like, everybody plays. Like, yeah.
Hell
so,
yeah.
So I started with that, but then I was like, kind of like on the bluesier side. Do you remember the band, Great White, who almost burned down that?
Oh yeah, of course. Yeah. So they were legends, dude.
Yeah, dude. They had this one song called Rock Me, and it was just this bluesier than blues intro, you know, just this real smooth two note intro. And it was just like, I don't know. There was something about it that called to me. And I brought it to my guitar teacher. I'm like, I want to learn this. And he's, you know, to set me on my way. But yeah, it was the bluesier side of things, but don't get me wrong. The that little Washburn, you know, you crank up the drive and it got nasty really quick. And
I always think like, you know, the hairband era was such a, like, you know, my family's Indian. My parents came from India and I had a Skid Row poster. You know, the guy had the like earring from his nose to his ear, huge poster, like hanging in my room. Like, oh yeah. And I'm just thinking now, like, my parents must have been like, this America thing is crazy because I would never see something like that in my, you know, my own room growing up. So I'm sure they were just like, he'll grow out of it. And I was like, no way, Skid Row for life. Because it was an era. It was like
Skid Row, 18 in life. And like
right.
all those songs, man. And yeah, just crank the radio up on the car. I mean, forget about it. You know, all throughout high school.
Guns N' Roses. For me, I remember it was Guns N' Roses. Yeah. Def Leppard, like all those bands that came out in that era. I mean, Def Leppard was here before, but Hysteria and Guns N' Roses were pretty much the biggest two records that came out like around the like 1990, something like that. So yeah, I just remember just being like, oh my God, this is what MTV's all about. This is everything, you know?
It was. I mean, what Guns N' Roses did, blues band, right? It keeps coming up. Like Led Zeppelin was an amazing blues band in the 70s. It did something different with it. Same thing with Guns N' Roses, blues band, but they, you know, they blew it up and had Axl Rose screaming like Janis Joplin, you know. Have you ever gone back and listened to some of the Guns N' Roses songs like Mr. Brownstone?
Oh, yeah, those are great. Those are so great.
They're so good. And all of the different, like, key changes that they did back then. Like, you can't do that on radio now. But, you know, back then it was like, okay, we're going to modulate. You know, we're going to go up a fourth. We're going to go up, like, a whole step. It's nuts.
Well, man. And also, like, what's cool about Guns N' Roses, and I could say this because you grew up in the same era. It's like, when Use Your Illusion 1 and 2 came out after Appetite for Destruction, it was like the world was just waiting for this. I mean, it was just like an unbelievable experience to see those two records come out and then also go through the Appetite for Destruction. You know, that whole thing was just, you saw music videos where people are fainting and they're just touring the world. It's like, this is crazy. Whatever this is, it's the best party ever. You know what I mean? And it's just like, it had to plant little seeds, probably in you and I both, like, okay, whatever that is looks way cooler than what anybody else is doing for their jobs, because it just looks like it's more fun. You know what I mean? So when did you start, like, did you start a band when you were like maybe 14, 15? Did you start a high school band?
Yeah. So what was it, seventh grade, roughly, or like sixth or seventh grade, I started playing, and then my brother got a drum set. And
it's all over now.
And the two of us would just get into this tiny room off of the garage and just pound away for hours. And we had like a, you know, little boom box with the record. We put the tape in there and we record our song. I mean, pop it out. And we, you know, like, Mom, you got to hear this.
Like, she's like, not now, I'm cooking dinner.
What's the line from Airplane? Hey, Johnny, how about some coffee? No, thanks. That was my mom, you know. And we'd be like, okay, we're gonna go back and try to play some more and, you know, come up with a new song even better than the first one. But yeah, that was like around 13 or 14. And then we had our first big show at the end of eighth grade, which is how old my oldest kid is right now, which is crazy.
Wow.
You know, to think that, like, he's the same age as I was back then. But yeah, we played like we put together this montage of like Guns N' Roses, Bullet Boys, I think like an Ozzy Osbourne song. And we played at the talent show at the end of eighth grade, you know.
That's awesome.
And you know, kids were like screaming and standing in their seats and stuff. And I'm just like, oh, yeah.
This is the life for me.
And my mom's like, you know, you have to get a real job. And I'm like, yeah.
We'll talk about that later. Yeah. Talk to my manager first. We'll
My dad's sitting there like, he's gonna play some gigs, it's gonna be okay.
So what happened after that? Did you guys kind of start playing more, like, you know, I think the lot of the people will play like high school dances or like things like that, or did the band kind of fizzle and you kind of started writing songs? When did you start singing? When did that all kind of take place?
Yeah, and that's a good point about writing songs. You know, we wrote songs, but they did, you know, not too many of them saw the light of day in high school. It was all about the cover band scene. You had to play the songs that all the other kids knew, and we would have talent shows like every year. So my brother and I would be putting together bands. Then when we got to high school, we were playing with some of the upperclassmen who we thought were cooler than cool, and that they actually wanted to play with us was pretty impressive. So yeah, at the end of every year, we were lucky enough that the music teacher from middle school moved up to the high school, and she brought my brother and I into the music department earlier than we should have. So you know, I was like a sponge, just like, give me everything. You know, we were talking about Mozart, we were talking about opera, we were talking about the Beatles, you know. Wow. She was heavy into the Beatles, and then how it all ties together. I started learning music theory, which I still use some of the stuff. Yeah, my music teacher.
Wait, in high school you were learning music theory?
Oh yeah, as a freshman.
Oh, that's crazy. Wow.
Yeah. And I became, it was like that, like it just clicked, you know. Yeah, my music teacher's name was Dot DeZamba, and she was just, oh my gosh, she was just generous. You know how like some music teachers hold back, and they're like, well, you're not ready for that piece. It's funny, when I got to college, not to jump ahead, but the second school I went to was Hofstra, and I studied music there, and they were like, you know, we're not going to give you this piece until you've had this piece. I just came from Berklee College of Music, man. And it's right. Like one of these open systems where, like, you know, all the music is out there. Anyway, I'm getting ahead of it. But yeah, so my brother
weird
and I
how different schools do different kind of like trains of thought, you know. It's like,
yeah,
it's weird. It's and then you realize that none of that matters. It's just about finding what gravitates to your soul and learning and developing and growing from that. Like, that's the way I kind of feel like all music schools, and especially all schools, should teach, but it's like they have to give some kind of fundamental. I get it. It's like, it's weird.
It's super weird. And I apologize. I get the talking super fast when I get excited about that shit.
No,
awesome. Can I swear or no?
You can swear. Fuck yeah, you can swear. I'm telling you, my folks are listening though. They're gonna send me a text, and be like, tell John he's on the swear jar too.
Hello to Mom and Dad Krula. Like, that's
all
awesome.
Right. That's all right.
Oh God, I love your parents, man.
They're awesome. They're awesome.
But yeah, no, it's an interesting thing to talk about. You know, it's like when music is it's doled out, you know, and then kids become curious about it. Why does that work? Why does this work? You know, we even like analyzed Blackbird by the Beatles. Why does that work?
Oh, that's cool.
Half steps and these chromatic changes and stuff. And it's like when you make music something not to be feared, but you're just kind of adding it on, you know, and using it all. I don't, and you know, she would set us loose on different instruments. I started learning how to play piano at the same time. I don't know. That's my philosophy with music. Just if you put it out there, and the hungrier a kid is, you'll find them picking up things, and they'll surprise you every time, you know. And
well, it's so good that you had a teacher too that kind of like lit that fire in you, because those are the formative years where you kind of like trying to figure out what you want out of life. And when you have a teacher like that, they don't understand sometimes how pivotal they are, but they are so pivotal because she gave you your whole life a direction just with showing you some of those things because of her joy for it. You know what I mean? And that's really what it's all about.
Yeah. Yeah. It's weird. It's like a trust in the joy of it, I think. And she was really good at it. I mean, yeah, some of the upperclassmen were messing around and stuff and giving her a hard time about this or that, but I was just like, no, shut up. We're talking about this.
Stay out of it, Stu.
Stu.
I'm sure there was a Stu in Connecticut. There had to be.
I mean, as in every other guy named Stu in Connecticut, of course. But yeah, no. So my brother and I had a band, you know, different members in it throughout high school, and we would play at this or that. When I was a senior, that's when I had like a ton of fun. I wrote a song with two of my friends for graduation. It was my friends,
that's cool.
Libby and Linda. So here we were. I was 17 when I graduated, and we're writing a song with 3-part harmony. And we submitted it, and they're like, "Yeah, that's amazing." Awesome. So you know, to sing that in front of all your peers and your friends and your parents' friends was, it's empowering, you know. And it made it feel like, hey, man, anything is possible, which I think is like really important. You know, in small town Connecticut like that, and that's the whole small fish in a small pond, I guess, at that point.
Well, no, it's cool. But it's cool about it. It's like you're understanding so many things, like collaborating, working with people, creating something. And then you see the response too. I'm sure the response was great. And it's like, that gives you like this confidence. You're like, wait a minute, this is something I should consider, you know, more long-term. So what was that like? Spring into Berklee College of Music, did you choose that school first? Did you like audition for a couple schools? Did you know what you wanted to do as far as a music major? Tell me what that process was like for you.
I didn't want to go to school at first. I remember there wasn't a car ride with my parents, and they were talking about the SATs, and from the back of the minivan, I said something like, I'm not going to take the SAT. And I remember the car stopped and my dad pulled over to the side, you know. You know, my dad was a businessman. He had his MBA, you know, and, you know, he'd made a career for himself. So in his eyes, you know, music was something that you did on the side for fun, right, like we were talking about before. But you also have to have a day job because, you know, not everybody makes a living in music. And
right,
he's not wrong. But, you know, I think he was using his own fears and realities to kind of shape mine, which is both good because he was doing what he felt was right for me, but also somewhat constrictive. So
yeah,
I think that you know, the argument, I ended up losing it, of course, and taking the SATs, and my parents
were brutal,
like,
test. And I'm sure you know this, like now they're like, yeah, maybe we should get rid of this SAT test. And I'm like, are you kidding me? I grew up in an Indian household. My dad was like, yo, you're spending an entire summer learning vocabulary, and like I had cue cards the whole bit. I'm like, and now these kids are not gonna have to do an SAT test? Are you kidding me? I think you should do it regardless, just make them go through that because it's important. important, you know?
Yeah, it's the gauntlet in life. You know, if you can get through SATs, you're going to be okay. If you don't, then let's just give you some grants. You're going to be fine.
Amen. Amen. So you took the SAT, and then how did you figure out, you know what, I'm going to try and audition for a music school? And you chose one of the best music schools. How did that come about?
Yeah, I think that's what it was. It was like, you're going to go to school no matter what. And then I realized, hey, hold on a minute. I could go to a music school. So then we're both winning in a sense, you know, they had some, you know, English and other, you know, general studies stuff at Berkeley, but it felt like that was my out, like, and thus became a long life of diplomacy with me and my parents and eventually my spouse. they had this thing called, I forgot the name of it. It was something like, it was either the Road Tour or the Road Scholarship, but it was ROAD for Berkeley, where they were going city to city. I think they were out in LA or whatever, and you can audition in person for the professors there to try to get a scholarship. And I was only about 3 hours away from Boston in Connecticut. So, I applied, and they accepted, you know, the tape that I had submitted, and they're like, yeah, come on up. And I played what I had given them on the tape. And I look back on it and I wouldn't have been able to do it again if it wasn't for that music class where I was learning.
Every rose has its thorn.
No, it's Patience by Guns N' Roses.
Awesome.
No, I'm kidding.
Well, what did you play? You played an original song?
So I composed a couple of pieces. The only two that I can remember, one was like a jazz piece where it was a lot of, you know, major sevens, minor sevens, but I was, you know, I had my understanding of jazz and I didn't play by the rules. So I did different things and half steps.
That's cool. That's super then cool.
I was also super into Nuno Bettencourt and
Extreme. Love him.
And that he's still playing. He's still instructing.
I just saw him for the first time. I saw him for the first time like 2 weeks ago. He was so good at the Bellwether. It's a new venue in downtown.
Oh, I saw that.
Living Color opened for them, but I missed them because it just took me a little bit to get there. But Nuno was just insane. Nuno, you know, I don't know if you know this. Nuno opened for NK Band as Population One, and I didn't know it was Nuno Bettencourt. And I just remember watching him sound check, and I'm like, he was like giving the sound guy so much grief. He's like, this monitor sounds like shit. He's like, you got to get this thing out of here. And I was like, man, this guy is really brutal. Like, but now I know, I'm like, oh, it's Nuno Bettencourt. Like, of course, you have every right to say all those things because you're Nuno Bettencourt. You are the current Eddie Van Halen that is alive and well. You know what I mean?
He is the rightful heir of Eddie Van Halen, and the stuff that he does is even it's even his own thing. Like what he does with the funk Rick Beato does an amazing piece on Nuno when he interviews him, if you can check that out. Like
I'd love to check that out.
Yeah, he really digs into him and he's like, what do you know, it's what he's taking from Eddie and then what's totally Nuno's. But when I was a kid and Nuno was playing a lot of that funk stuff, like I had never really been exposed to that. So it was just nasty and it had distortion on it and it was just tight and everything, and you know, the bass and the drums and it drove me nuts. So I composed a Nuno-esque funk piece that to play.
That's awesome. Folks.
So they gave me a scholarship, you know, it was like a 2-year scholarship when I was there. And so I was like, yeah, let's go. And I showed up at 17, you know, all rosy cheeked and ready to go. And I don't know. I think I was a little bit young to go to school. I think I started school.
Well, did you like everybody's experience of that school? I mean, a lot of it's varied, but a lot of it's also the same. It's almost like it's super intense and you kind of like, you know, every musician, and I went through this too with music school. It's like you fall in love with music, you realize you can do this as a career, you apply to music school, and then music school tries to kill the love of music out of you. And you're like, what? Wait, what? I'm paying you to do what? You know, it's like, it they take all the fun out of it. And it's just like, was that your experience at Berkeley? Because I've heard mixed stories about a lot of the same.
So my first night there, my parents dropped me off with my steamer trunk. You know, my teal bed sheets, which were cool at the time, I'm sure.
Nice.
That first night, I was in the Commonwealth Wealth dorm, which is really nice. Just this old, you know, brownstone building in Boston. And here we were on the sixth floor. I didn't know anybody except for my my slightly off roommate. Most people at Berkeley are slightly off, but in a good
way. Yes, I can tell. I can tell. I'm sure they're like musically like genius too, you know.
Yeah, I mean, most people were, you know, like there are some cats there. A couple of my friends, one ended up, his name is Brad Mason, playing with John Mayer. He plays trumpet. His brother, Elliot Mason, plays with Wynton Marsalis in the wow. Lincoln Center, you know, so there is some serious, you know, like serious cats that blew through there, you know. And I come there and I'm like, you know, lit up on, you know, all my East Coast feed of music and everything. And that first night, everybody was hanging out. I had my guitar in the common area, and I started playing Peter Gabriel songs.
Nice.
Just super into Peter Gabriel. And I think maybe it was In Your Eyes. And what was cool is that everybody kind of came out, and it was almost like a scene from a John Hughes movie. And the singer started singing harmonies, and wow. You know, and somebody came out with like a tin and they're playing drums, and it's like, you know, Manu Katché, you know.
Wow.
And it was just like, oh my God, Berkeley's gonna be great. That was the one time that
you're like, that's orientation week one, now we go to class.
Everybody went back to the room and was like, what was with that kid and his guitar? It was weird. No, I'm kidding. But after that, yeah, everybody, it's just like what you said. It was like everybody kind of got real steeped in their studies and their homeworks and their ear trainings, which is invaluable. Their arrangements, which is great. You know, a little bit of counterpoint theory. And I don't know, as a music school, Berkeley does do it very well, but its lack of, like a student body function. When I was there, this is like the mid 90s. It was just like, you go to class and then we'll see you at class, you know?
Right.
It wasn't a lot of, you know, organizations and stuff like that. As a freshman, I was coming in and there was this, I was behind this bunch of guys giggling with this drum case, and they're going in the front door and saying hi to the guard. Hey, what's going on? Yeah, we're just coming back from rehearsal. Sure. And we're going up in the elevator, and they look at me and they're like, you want to go to a party? I'm like, what are you talking about? And they open up the drum case and there's a keg in there. I'm like, yeah, I like beer, you know?
So, hell yeah.
Well, it was like these older kids who had gone to a university and then went to Berkeley. And, you know, here I was as like a fresh 17-year-old kid. So like, there was like, you know, like they had a stripper in the dorm. I don't know if they got her in there in the case or whatever, but yeah. So, and then everybody would disappear like roaches when the lights would come on and go into their practice things, you know? And you know, there are those, you probably had them at your school. They almost look like refrigerator doors. And
yeah, the practice rooms. Totally.
And that's what it's at. Like, if you want to be a cat, you gotta practice and practice or whatever. But I found it both invigorating and isolating at the same time. It was a very interesting experience.
I found it like, you know, there were great things about it because it was like, wow, I finally am with my tribe. It was like, I'm in like a conservatory environment. This is what I've always kind of wanted. And then you hear kids just like practicing for 4 and 5 and 6 hours, and you're like, you know, I don't think I want to practice for 6 hours. Like, I want to enjoy my life too. I want to practice for maybe 2 hours. And what I've learned now, it's like a lot of those guys, I had a roommate that was a genius sax player, and he's not really playing music now. You know, it's like he kind of burned out because he was playing 6 to 8 hours a day and practicing, thinking that's what you had to do. And it was like, wow, man, I don't know if I could sustain that. Like, that to me is almost like crazy, but I also love the discipline. So in the back of my mind, I'm always like thinking, because of that experience, I'm like, oh, I need to be practicing. So there's a lot of that always going on. But you see a lot of this mechanical thing. I'm sure you dealt with it at Berkeley. I know for sure you did, because that is what the environment kind of ingrains in you. Like, oh, you need to be practicing in a room by yourself, not making music with people. But then I would come into my room or my apartment, and I'd have like an 8-piece funk band in my living room on a Wednesday at like 4 o'clock, and it would just be jamming. Right. And I was like, oh, this is where it's at. But I was studying opera. So like, I would, you know, go and that's sing great. Opera and then come into the my apartment and just see this funk band and be like, what is this? This is way cooler than what I'm doing. I mean, this is so what's interesting about it, and the reason I'm asking about it is these music schools, they do the isolating thing. They do bombard you with the academia of it. And the whole point of making music is with people. And social. They kind of forget the simple part of making music with people is why we do this. And making those connections and creating art together is why we make music. And I think it's a bummer because a lot of people like yourself go to these great schools and myself as well. And then you have these experiences that are not really like that at all. And it's kind of whack. So I love that you shared that because, so you finished the 2 years and then did you just, you were like, I don't want to do the program here for the rest. I'm going to go to a different school and kind of develop music. Like what made you switch?
Yeah, I got depressed. I think it takes the humanity out of it, you know, and as a kid, I wanted to, you know, have friends and we did, you know, we had Boston that we would, you know, gallivant around and stuff. And I had a great group of friends, but
you gallivant or would you cruise?
We had no cars.
I just gleeked trying to get that joke out because I was so excited. I'm like, who gallivants?
It was gallivanting.
John gallivants.
What do music students do in Boston in the middle of winter? I mean, we were kicking a can on a frozen pond in Boston Gardens. That's gallivanting.
Right. Okay. I get it. All right. Carry on. You're gallivanting and then you're realizing.
No, we had fun a lot. And, you know, I think I actually like, but from talking to my friends and stuff, I started to develop a love for philosophy and you know, just talking about things. And that's where, you know, somebody would say, hey, man, have you heard of Kierkegaard? You know, and then like be pulling a blunt out of their mouth, you know. that was my introduction, you know. And then in the same breath of philosophy is like, hey, man, we want some Miles Davis. I'm like, what are these drugs? It's kind of. So the second year I was like, all right, I had a bunch of roommates. My second roommate was cool, but I'm like, maybe I want a room by myself. They opened up a new building on Hemingway right near the Fens. And I'm like, yeah, it'll be great. And I was going to try to get a room next to my friend. Didn't work out. I got a room in the back on the first floor next, you know, where there was no sunlight. There was a car parked outside that when the bums would hit it, it would start to run an alarm at night. It was just like fucking worse, man.
Wow.
And so I started to get really down.
And you're like, come on, are you kidding me?
Yeah, it's like I started with Peter Gabriel on the whole floor and then there's just bums in the car alarm, you know? And so I tried to change my room and everything and it was a hassle and I finally did, but then I'm just like, you know, maybe this school isn't right for me. And, you know, it just, you know, it just wasn't working out. I mean, the minute I decided to leave, by the way, I get into a band with a bunch of friends. My juries allowed me to be in a couple of, what do you call it? Ensembles. That's,
yep,
you
know,
that's,
yep. Combos. That's really cool. Yeah. We did that. We do that too. Yep.
Yeah. And I didn't go in with like a lick of like real jazz expertise. So like getting my juries up to par so I can actually, you know, and when I finally did, they brought me into this ensemble and, you know, they were just playing like Eagles and stuff. And there's like, is anybody can sing? And I kind of raised my hand, I can sing. And then the guy's like, see me after class. And he's like, listen, I'm going to bump you up to this other ensemble that you're not qualified for, but they need a singer, you know? And then I started to say to myself, aha, sing water. Yeah. So that worked out. So, but yeah, by then I was out the door. So then I decided I was going to try to stay in Boston, but I couldn't afford it, you know, to go to like Boston College or Boston University. So, my twin brother, was going to Hofstra on Long Island and my parents were like, you know, give it a try. So I did, I tried it out. It was okay. That was the school where I learned business, of music, which was really helpful and a little bit of, like synth and technology and sampling and more,
I didn't know this when you sent me your bio, I didn't know that you were an A&R, you worked at an A&R. You worked at A&M Music, is that right, in New York?
Yeah, Extremes label and Janet Jackson and Patty Griffin and everything. The Police. Every time I turned over a CD or a record, it was A&M. So I'm like, let me try those guys. And yeah, so I went for an interview and they took me. It was at that time where I still had my dad's voice in the back of my head. You know, like, be a musician, but have a real job going on too. So then I started to think, maybe if I'm gonna get a job, at least I get a job in music or whatever. So I interned in A&M Records and on, what was it, 8th Street in New York City. In there 2 days a week, you know, the whole subway thing. It was, you know, I really felt like a real New Yorker for a little while.
That's awesome. Yeah, I never knew that part of your story. It's so crazy.
Oh, right on, man. No, I appreciate that. Yeah, it was cool. I mean, I learned a lot. You know, it's I was working for this he was the head of A&R, Jim Phelan, I think was his name. But he discovered a bunch of people. I learned about the whole process. That's where I started to learn about what a producer does. They had this whole file cabinet of all the different producers and I had to file it. So I would pull up a sheet of this producer and it would have all of his credits. And I'm like, what does a producer do? You know, why are they needed? And why does this, all these artists? So that was a separate kind of education that was really important there. But yeah, I ended up graduating and then I just said, okay, well, I'm going to get a job at an A&R and, you know, while I'm trying to make it work from Connecticut. It's about an hour and a half train ride from where I was in Connecticut. And getting an apartment in New York City was cost prohibitive even at the time. I can't imagine what it's like now. But yeah, I went in for interview after interview and then it started to come up short. Oh, we don't have any positions, not even on entry level, you know, and it was getting harder and harder to come in. I remember, one guy said, go work at like Coca-Cola for a year and then reapply and then you'll look better. And I'm like, I don't want to go work at fucking Coca-Cola. That's why I'm interviewing with you guys.
That is the music industry right there. It's like, hey, you want to work in music? Yeah, it's all busy over here. Go across the street. And it's like, and you're like looking at the guy telling you that, and you're like, well, what did you do? You seem like you don't fit here, but yet you have a gig here. Like, what is up with that? You know, and that's the music industry. There's so much of that. Yeah. It's crazy.
And it's just like, it's because it was just most of the guys that worked there or girls were a producer or, you know, they had worked with an artist and then that's how they got signed and brought into the, or not signed or whatever you call it, hired by the record company, or they got a job before Napster hit, you know, and that's what I was dealing with is what I found out. It's like, I don't know who said it, if it was, Dave Grohl or somebody, where he's, you know, like whole floors of record companies were turning out their lights. And here I was like, hey, any openings or anything?
No. Yeah. Right. And you know what I love, though, is that it still didn't deter you from playing in a cover band and playing music live and playing to rooms of 500. And you're like, you know what? Who cares? Like, that's the love of music. That's what I love about you, too. That's why we're friends. Like, you went through all of that, and you were still, like, you went through the kind of shitty music school experience. You went through the shitty kind of internship, like, that you had to do. And yet you're still like, yo, this is what I still want to do. I want to play music. So you're playing at all these, you know, cool venues. You're playing for 500-plus people. And then you decide to come out west. And I love that. I know that's where you met your wife too. You met your wife. Didn't you meet Irene in New York?
In Connecticut. Hold on. Let me close my door.
That's right.
The natives are getting restless. Hold on.
All right. No worries.
Hey, Grant, keep it down. Grant, please keep it down.
Living that dad life, bro. Living that dad life. I keep clicking all over the place.
Jimmy, like pleading with them to keep it quiet.
please, I need this interview.
Let's try to be polite in front of
them. Yeah. No, it's good. You're like, if this interview wasn't going on, you'd be getting a spanking.
Daddy's going to be off pretty soon. Yeah, that's a different character. That character will come out later. I told you to be quiet.
So you meet the love of your life, and then I remember you both moved out here together, right?
That's right. Yeah. So I met Irene and I both met at the same day. We started the same day at this company. It was a .com company. It had nothing to do with music because, like my dad said, I needed to make money. You know, while I was playing in that cover band, you know, we were making some cash, but not enough. So I met her, and she's from California, and she spent one winter in Connecticut, and she's like, no thanks. And so she's right. Like, yeah, I got a chance to move back, you know. She got a great job in television, you know, in research, and she's like, yeah, so I'm gonna take it, you know. And there's that pregnant pause where I kind of said,
Can I come? Right.
You know, it was very romantic, I think. Maybe. I don't know. It was a whirlwind romance until...
No, but you know what's cool about it is, like, she's from here. Yeah. And you know that LA is one of the cities. Like, you just know it's one of the music cities.
It's New York or it's LA. Until Nashville, you know. And now Nashville's more of a town.
And you came out here when we actually met at Guitar Center when you were, I think you were buying a guitar. You were looking for a guitar.
Yeah.
You just came and then just were looking at the guitars, and we became good buds from that moment on. And I remember we started playing shows together. We started playing acoustic sets. You started building a band with Anthony Tadeo, with T.
Yep.
And then you started Gus Company. We played shows together at House of Blues. We did all this stuff. And you were just in this place of, like, writing, recording. There must have been a point where you're like, okay, this is all about original music. This is a different hustle. It's harder in some ways, but it's also more gratifying in some ways. And you're finding that process. Tell me how that was different for you.
It was always so awesome watching you do your hustle.
I'm still doing it. I'm getting old, bro.
You don't look it. It is still the energy. I think that, you know, I had a good knack of putting together good teams of people. Like when I was in Connecticut and we were playing those 500 plus rooms, you know, and I don't know if we were selling out, but we were doing really good. And it was a team of people that were doing different things, you know, and I was recruiting people, and then one guy was getting the gigs, and when you're young, you've got this big group of friends and stuff. Coming out here, I had nobody. I knew no one, you know, until you. Maybe I was a little too hungry when I met you. I'm like, do you want to be my friend?
Like,
no, buddy. I just want to sell you a guitar. Man. Like, chill out.
And then at the bed, can you grow a mustache?
Give me 20 years. I definitely respect your hustle and your drive and the way that it was. I had trouble doing the writing, the rehearsing, the websites, and, you know, getting people to come out, having to invite people out in the city in Los Angeles.
It's such Hollywood. A grind. It's still a grind. And you know it's, what?
Yeah.
But you know what? You know, I don't know if you feel like this. Now I've gotten to a point, like, I played big shows. Like, I don't care. I want people to show up, but I'm not going to, it's like, yo, come if you can.
Yeah.
And if you don't, it's okay. Like, no worries. Like, everybody's got their lives. And the irony is, like, people keep coming, and I'm like, oh, okay, cool, keep coming. But I know you. I know that same feeling where it's like, oh my God, do I gotta send this? I gotta send a text, or like, hey, have a phone call, or here's an email, or blah 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 blah. Yeah, it's a hustle, it's a grind, but do it because we love it, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I made so many mistakes, but I think the biggest one was assuming that, you know, like that my friends were always gonna come to all the shows, and then after a while, like friend rock gets old, you know, and friends are like, hey, man, you know, it's I can't come to your show again this weekend, or yeah, it's
right.
It's hard, and the clubs in LA expect you to bring every single person. You know, it's
crazy.
A revolving door. Like there, I remember I would load in, and like when I would play the Roxy, they had this club called On the Rocks up there. It's great little club. It's kind of like the perfect balance of a well known club but a smaller room. You know,
right.
So that you really feel the energy of the crowd there. We had some great shows there, but man, we would show up, and you know. It would be so packed as you would be loading in your stuff in the back room to play that you'd think, oh my God, where are my people going to go?
Right.
Surprise. As soon as that band is done, that whole room clears out like a fire drill.
All you people, you got plenty of room.
And I'm right. Okay. I guess you have plenty of room, you know? So it's that also makes it hard to get new fans from other bands, you know, and maybe a lot of those are friend rock. So, yeah. And you know, I think that the scene's constantly evolving, especially in Hollywood, but, the best clubs, to your earlier points, are the more, in my opinion, intimate ones like Hotel Cafe.
Well, you are a monster musician, great guitar player, great singer, great writer.
Thank you, man.
I don't want to run out of time, so let's play something and showcase that, and then we'll talk about it. What do you want to play first?
Let's play Too Close to You.
All right, what's the name of the band again? Dear Emmy?
Yeah, so this is Dear Emmy. This is the Americana project that I started with my longtime writer partner, Sarah Cardness.
Here's Dear Emmy with Too Close for You. Hold on, it's coming. What happened?
This time.
It's coming. Hold on, Sam. We got it? Hold on. He's saying something in the chat. What is he saying?
Can't play the songs.
He said trouble. Can't play the songs. Okay, weird. Can we play any of the songs, Sam? Let's see. This one. Weird. What is going on, Sam? I thought we just had them. All right. Well, let's see. Hold on. He says, sorry, it played earlier.
Yeah, we were listening to him play earlier.
You know what? Let me see. You got a guitar on you? Why don't you play live? Play something live.
All right.
We're going to pivot. While Sam figures this out, you're going to play us a song. This is why I can do this with you, because you can actually play and write and sing. So let's do it this way. Weird. That's a first.
Let's see what we got here. Just give me a second. I'm going to tilt the mic a little bit towards the guitar. You let me know if you can hear it.
No problem.
All right. Can you guys hear that?
Yep. That sounds good. What are you going to play us?
I'll play the song Said and Done from Dear Emmy.
Okay, cool.
We took all the things we thought really mattered and threw them all away like a pile of magazines. Nothing heals a heart once it's been shattered, so my belief. We drove all the way down to Louisiana just to run down another second chance and try and recreate the bit of that old magic and build a dream. And you said, hold me again like you mean it. Remind me where we come from. Will you only really want me when I'm leaving? When everything's been said and done, said and done. It's a nice piece for you.
That's awesome, dude. Such a killer song. I love that you're going in this Americana direction. It's always been a major influence for you. Tell me, like, you started this project with an artist that you met her while you were in another band, right? A cover band that the guitarist broke his finger in a garage door, right? Is that the girl that you started the group with?
Yeah, my really good friend Sarah. She did the Nashville round when she was coming up, and I think the group's name was Sister South, and she had her partner, and they were doing their thing. She ended up leaving Nashville, having a family and everything, and then she kind of got that itch, as you know. You can't, once you start, man, you can't stop playing. So
yeah.
So absolutely. She came back to it, put a band together, and in the process of rehearsing for their show, the guitar player was closing his garage door and just absolutely just wrenched his middle finger on his left
hand.
So at the time I was playing with a drummer in another project, and he's like, hey man, you know, you play guitar and sing. Why don't you try this out? And so I showed up for rehearsal and we played one song and Sarah and I were just looking at each other like, oh man, that's it. Like the harmonies were right there. Like we instantly sang. And like that goes back to when I was a kid. There's something about like, I love singing harmonies, you know, with between a man and a woman. There's just something about that blend that just drives me nuts, man. So we became fast friends. That band did a lot of cool stuff. We opened up for some from national acts and stuff like Dina Carter and Christian Bush and
awesome.
Yeah, played some cool gigs with that band, killer band. And it ran its course in its own way, and that's when she and I started this Dear Emmy project, which is interesting. It was a lot of the softer Americana songs that didn't work for the country band, and it's the one that
what's cool about that, like everybody loves the Plant and Krause vibe. A lot of your songs have that vibe, and it's like funny because like I love Alison Krauss. I love Led Zeppelin, Robert Plant. But when those two come together, there's something magical about it. And that sound is so great. And when I heard the Dear Emmy stuff, I'm like, oh my God, I love this already because it's very much in that Americana, like it's kind of like the new Americana sound. And it is so good. So dude, I hope like this project is always a thing because
thank you, brother.
It's so good. You want to play something else? Let me see if Sam, let us know if we can play any of the studio tracks. I don't know what's going on with the YouTube links, but
in Sam's defense, he's like, hey man, send me some MP3s. And I only have like the big wave files. So it's definitely on me.
Oh, that's right. You could have sent that. Let's see. Hold on. Let's see. Should we try? Let me see.
Should I try a wave
file? He said he's going to try in a minute. All right. We're going to try one more song, but you know what? In the meantime, maybe play us a little snippet and then
do
records with this project because it's just awesome. And I love the guitar work too. Like, man, it sounds awesome. What were you playing through? You're playing through a Strat?
That's actually that's Paul Riddell, the producer, who I met at Hotel Cafe. Really good friend of mine. I played the acoustic guitars on that, but he took care of all the electrics.
You can play the electrics. You tell him to scoot, man. Take over those electrics. No, man. Yeah, I mean, I love your acoustic playing, but dude, I've always, you know, like we used to jam all the time, and like,
thank you, brother.
A ferocious musician. Like you are, actually were one of the reasons I started taking my first guitar solo. You were the reason. You're like, you need to get up there and play guitar solo. So like, man, your guitar work is just incredible. Where can people find you if they want to find you online? We're running out of time, but I'm going to have you back on because of the glitches and stuff, but where can people find you online? Where can people find this project? Tell all the websites or all the Instagram handles that you have.
Yeah, so I'm on Instagram at the Johnny Gus, the as in the THE Johnny Gus. That band is Dear Emmy, DEAR, and then space MEEMMY. We are everywhere. So that's on Spotify, Apple Music, YouTube, everywhere that you get your music there. And interestingly, that song is going to be featured as a jazz version in a new movie that's coming out.
Awesome. Yeah, talk about that.
Later this year, a movie called L.A. Grit. Sarah and I, along with my good friend Nick Gomez, who's an L.A. He's a jazz saxophone player in his own killer band in L.A.
Very cool.
The three of us got together and wrote 12 plus jazz standard songs, which takes me back, in 3 weeks, man.
Wow.
And then had to demo them, and we were recording the actors, all female singers, all women singers singing these just amazing songs, these amazing voices. So Too Close to You, Sarah and I converted to a jazz standard song from that Americana thing. It's cool. So check it
all
out.
All those jazz chops at Berkeley helped out, man. It helped.
All my complaining. Yeah, they actually did me justice and got me this gig. So,
the movie's called LA Grit.
It should come out later this year, 2024.
And you're in the movie as one of the band members, right?
Yeah. My good friend, the director, Ryan, director and writer, Ryan Curtis, was like, hey man, we're going to need some band members in back of the starlets as they're like singing in this club. So could I please?
Was this on or was it?
Sadly not.
Oh God!
Yeah, but
that's criminal, bro. That's criminal.
Believe it or not, I play. I fake playing trumpet in the background. That's the Hollywood secret.
That's awesome. Well, that's awesome. That makes sense. It's Hollywood. You're a multi instrumentalist. You play banjo, mandolin. Just add trumpet now, because now people will see some footage.
I love you, man.
I love you too, man.
Get me, man.
Hey, use it. Put it on there, dude. We are long overdue for a jam. We're gonna have to hang. We're gonna have to write some music too. But I'm gonna have you back on the show because of the technical glitches. But
thank you
again for being a guest on Wake Up Hollywood. You're a terrific musician, terrific songwriter, terrific singer, terrific person. And yeah, man, we definitely have to hang and jam soon and just make more music, because you're all giggles and music and jazz trumpet playing. So that's what I want to make sure we keep it up. But thank you for being a guest on Wake Up Hollywood. On behalf of Sam, myself, and John, check out Dear Emmy and all of John's music whenever you can find it on all the social platforms, and check out the new movie, L.A. Grit. We'll see you guys next week. Peace, love, and take care.
You're listening to Wake Up Hollywood with Nikki Corulla and Eddie Pence, right here on LA Talk Radio.